Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris. This week we're doing... Oh, shoot. Hold on. What are we calling it?
Spooktacular.
Spooktacular. Or spooktastic. No. We'll get into if it's spooktastic or spooktacular later.
Okay. Is that what you prepared? Are those your notes?
You guys are ruining my notes. Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week we're looking for the most spooktacular book.
No, listen, you need to get more momentum ramping up to it.
No!
When you hit spooktacular, you don't laugh yourself.
Spooktacular book ever written. To help me are two spooky guys, two high school English teachers, Ian and Joe.
The spookiest profession, many say.
Oh, I'm Joe Holshue. Happy spooky season, Ian and Nick. And on a serious
happy spooky
note,
season happy to you, spooky Joe.
Season.
Happy spooky season to you, Joe.
Thank you. Hey, I'm a high school English teacher.
Hold on, Joe. Yes. Hold on. Yep. Hey, listeners. Hey, litheads. Happy spooky season to you.
Hey, happy spooky season. I'm Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And this week, Nick, if you are looking for a spooktacular book, for a spooktastic book, I would recommend the Henry James novella, The Turn of the Screw, written in 1898.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung, and I'm a high school English teacher. And I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld this eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise, he did them. Are we doing this? Or should I not? Is this
one of us is.
Infringement?
This is the monster. No, mash. I think if you say it like a rap, you're good.
Oh, it's a fair use because I'm parodying.
Yep, because you rapped it. Yep.
Yes, parody.
Yep.
Clearly, what I just did was 100%.
Clearly, you're doing a joke.
No, I'm serious. This happened to me. You guys not believe me? I was totally working in the lab late one night.
Are you going to introduce yourself or fucking what?
Yeah, I already did. I told you I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes... I'm sorry, I keep getting off on that. I'm going to tell you about a great spooky book. So I would say the most spooktacular book of them all, namely Dracula by Bram Stoker, Irish author and noted author Bram Stoker. That's all. That's all I got, actually.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Bram, I always assumed he was like a Romanian author, right? I'd never heard the name Bram before.
That's crazy because like, I was playing trivia and someone like this was one of the questions like where was Bram Stoker from? And I was like, oh, clearly from Slovakia. And
then, obviously,
nope. Turns out he is just a Irish fella. He was the business manager of a theater.
Wow.
From he's humble just like beginnings. Some random dude who wrote an amazing novel, which gives
so
me
just
hope.
Take away all that like spooky mystery and
yeah,
nope, like, he was a manager.
There's something about Irish author, manager of a theater. That doesn't sound that spooky.
It doesn't. It does not. It's fascinating.
Hey, I got something for you guys.
Oh, please.
Okay.
Give me something.
Okay.
Ready.
Book.
Good. Very good.
Oh.
Did you come up with that on your own?
Actually, I spitballed it with my wife a little bit earlier.
You workshopped it.
I workshopped that one this afternoon.
The first draft? What did the first draft sound like?
It was kind of just book. I didn't really hit the O's as hard.
I feel like there should be more of like a tremble in the middle, like boo.
Well, you know, if you bring this stuff to the table, you can do it however you want, Joe.
Well, I wasn't invited to the workshop, so I would like to be invited to collaborations.
It's a private workshop.
I was invited to the workshop, but I had a thing at that time, so I couldn't go.
Mm-hmm. It was in a lab.
It was, you know, I was working in the lab late one night when my, sorry.
Yep, no, we did that already. So, guys.
Yeah.
I'm ready to be scared. So let's just go over the show rules real quickly. Only unavoidable spoilers. Omit needless words, Joe. And winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. Guys, before we proceed, let's hear your 30-second plots.
Are we going to go over the show rules?
We already did that.
Oh, we did.
You weren't listening.
I'm sorry. I was distracted by...
If he brings up his fucking lab one more time...
This monster is just doing the mash. I'm sorry.
Joe?
Yes, Nick, I'm ready. What do you need, Nick? Nick, how can I help?
Why don't you give us your 30 seconds of plot points?
Nick, the turning of the screw is what would happen if Jane Eyre met The Shining. It has everything. It has creepy children, spooky houses.
Are you quoting somebody else for your 30-second plot?
I'm quoting
like the back
wife.
Of the book?
My wife insists on credit for that. I was explaining this to her, and then she said, oh, so it's like Jane Eyre meets The Shining. And I was like, fuck, I have to say that. She's like, well, give me credit. I wasn't going
he
to
wasn't
give her
going
credit.
To.
Yeah.
No,
oh,
I wasn't. No.
Well, that's your time, Joe.
Oh, no, I have so much more to say.
That went so well.
Oh,
all right. Your wife is going to win this week. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, it sounds great.
Jane Eyre meets The Shining, guys.
You're
it
here
has
first.
Everything.
Ian, yeah. Tell us about Dracul.
Should I do this in the accent,
yes,
or not?
I'm going to need you to do full Transylvanian accent for the remainder of the episode, please.
Great. Perhaps the most spookiest book ever described is Dracula by Bram Stoker. If you want chills, thrills, frights,
time.
Bats, rats, the
time, please
cheese,
stop.
The willies, terror, mystery, hypnotism, a dude who eats flies and spiders, action, intrigue, and a surprisingly
going,
large amount of logistical strategizing with train schedules, you should open the door of your heart and invite the story in.
I'm suddenly concerned that might have been an incredibly racist impression.
Yep, like maybe.
We might have just offended every Transylvania.
Yep. Ian, just a quick time check. You have another 45 minutes. Just keep going. Read us the book. Read us the first 7 chapters in that voice.
The top.
Wow, truly terrible. I kind of want to keep that sweet Dracula energy going, so let's roll right into Dracula. Okay. So, Ian, I was, full disclosure, I was going to start looking up Keanu Reeves quotes for this particular segment from the movie Dracula.
Yep.
But I just kind of quickly realized that his quotes are just passages from the book, which is pretty good.
Yep.
So that didn't really work out.
That's
so,
Keanu Reeves
I guess just a heads up, there will be no Keanu Reeves quotes.
Oh.
Okay. Guys, I think I need to stop because it's the only reason I came here. That and to tell you guys about the lab that I was working in. This was sustaining me, honestly. And now
we could
this
quote
news is bad.
Keanu Reeves from other movies. Right? Keanu Reeves has a storied filmography.
I'm so far ahead of you.
Yep. Fantastic. Thank you, Nick.
Great. Good. Hey, guys. So... I would love to talk to you about this book, Dracula by Bram Stoker. So here's the thing. This book contains multitudes. As I was reading it, so I crashed through it really fast this past weekend just to refresh myself. I'm so glad I did. I was realizing that practically every vampire trope has some kind of origin here. And I'll talk like in a minute about like the origins of vampire stories. But I wondered if you guys could like... name as many vampire tropes as you can, and I will tell you if it shows up in this. And so if you, every time you name one that shows up in the book, you get what I call a tooth point or a point tooth.
Pointy
teeth,
that.
You know?
What if we name one that doesn't show up in the book? Like, what if we name a commonly held vampire?
Eternal damnation?
I think Wesley Snipes will show up at your doorstep and say something really, really cutting to you.
That's high stakes.
Yeah, high stakes.
Fuck. Oh, I'll go first. Stakes, wooden stakes.
Go.
Oh, dang. They drink blood.
One point to Nick. Go ahead, Joe.
They drink blood. Vampires drink blood.
Boo.
Yep, one for you.
That's fucking lame.
What? You said
obviously
wooden
there's
stakes.
Blood in this, Joe. Stop padding your answers. He's going to guess one sharp tooth and then another sharp tooth for his fucking...
Hey, Nick, it's your turn. How about you guess your own thing?
A red cape.
No.
Red cape?
But I will allow fancy clothes. Like,
oh,
fancy clothes are a big part of this. Yes, go. Joe.
They sleep in coffins.
Big boxes of earth, but yes, again, I'll allow it.
Got it.
It's just very lenient rules. I'm going to go.
They do
I'll,
end up.
I'll take the points. The tooth points, as we're calling them.
There are.
Very good.
There are. Sharp teeth. Absolutely.
Sharp teeth points. Yep. I'm going to go ahead and say they turn into animals.
Yes. Good. Specifically.
Wait, just animals, not bats?
Yes. Shape shifting.
There's also Dracula himself also has the ability to turn into a dog.
Oh, cool. I didn't
like
know
a big,
that.
Nasty dog. Yep. Okay, wow. Joe, do you have one?
Yeah,
like a corgi.
I have 1,000 more. He turns into a corgi.
He turns into a toy poodle.
Vampires, of course, are they're men of means. They're wealthy. They have titles like count.
Okay, feels a bit like a cop out, but yes, okay. Count Dracula.
Their names are Dracula.
You know what I think it is. I think vampires live a long time, and I think they take advantage of compound interest. I think that's their secret.
That's a good call.
Yep. Accumulated wealth.
That's my favorite part of vampire stories is the like the serious investigation into how they made their money in the banks.
That's right. I'm here for the train schedules and the investment strategy.
Ian, I'm going to go ahead and say Roth IRAs. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Well, you're not right. That's for sure.
When is this game over? Soon, I hope.
Could conceivably be my whole time to talk, but
I've got another one. Vampires are incredibly handsome. They're incredibly handsome. They seduce women. Vampires seduce women.
So this is a really interesting one, and this is a good place to stop because I feel like you're going to say something about sparkling next, and we really can't go there. So the thing about Count Dracula is he is not. There is like this magnetism and this kind of quasi-sexual attraction that the vampires in these stories have, but it's like it's like a blend of mind control and sort of animalistic
Jedi monster. Mind tricks.
Yeah, it's wow. Jedi mind tricks. It's all Jedi mind tricks. So that's what I'm it's thinking, yes, man. they're attractive, but it's very much like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And Stoker does he's very careful to say, now listen, people. Even though they were super beautiful and everyone wanted to be with them, also they were evil. So he really insists on that.
Maybe you're going to get into this, Ian, but isn't it worth saying that he invented all of these? Like,
it is not.
This is the first. It's the first vampire book, isn't it?
It's not. I was so bummed about that. It's not. It's not the first vampire book.
All right.
So I looked into this.
Nick, any more guesses?
No, but that's what I bring to this show. Wild guesses.
Wild guesses.
I try to ruin honest, your notes.
Wild fucking hairs.
That's what we're all doing.
Just
here.
Chasing a notion.
Keep it up, Joe. I'll ruin all your notes next.
I still have like 6 lines left in my 30-second summary.
Yeah, okay.
So when I was preparing for this podcast, I went down to the lab and I was looking at this book and it turned out I was writing my notes under the impression that it was the first vampire book. And I was like, maybe I'll just go double check that. And it absolutely wasn't. The first vampire book was the first vampire story in English was written back in the early 1800s. And the sort of vampire myth had been around in Central Europe, which is just replete with spooky myths. It had been around there since, time immemorial, the mists of time. So it is the most well-known, and I would argue perhaps the best vampire story ever written, but we cannot say it was the first, which is a real bummer.
What about, okay, maybe not the first, quote-unquote, you know, bloodsucker, but like, are all the vampire tropes that we know, like, are they all from Bram Stoker's Dracula, or did those exist in the other published book or whatever it was?
Yeah, so I think some of the, Stoker did a bunch of research for this book, and so a lot of the stuff that he does
hands-on research?
Yes, he was actually a vampire himself, and it was a huge scandal.
Yep, big at the time.
He did this research, and so he knew the folklore and had this connection to the folklore, so that he sources a lot of his folklore or a lot of his lore in this book from preceding Central European folklore. But he does it in a really interesting way. He says he frames it as he has this expert in the book, Abraham von Helsing, and von Helsing is a student of the folklore traditions. And so von Helsing is like, listen, all the peasants say you got to use garlic, you got to use a crucifix, like all this stuff. And so what Stoker does is he sources this stuff in real folklore. In the fiction, he puts the sources as real folklore. And yet this novel was so influential and has become so popular that now, instead of referring to the folklore, I think we refer to this novel. This has become the new source, which is insane when you think about it. Like, there were hundreds of years of people telling stories about vampires, and Bram Stoker, the business manager of a theater, comes along and writes such a good story that we begin to turn to that for our source. I think that's crazy. I think that's awesome.
So, Ian, I'm familiar with your book.
You are?
It's one of, yeah,
you've read it before?
Yeah, I got through like 75% of it.
Really?
Yeah, I really like it.
That's fascinating. So you did not. So this is a new one, actually. This is a book that you have some familiarity with, but did not finish. Now, why didn't you finish it? Is it because you were kind of like busy reading it and then you put it down to go work in the lab and then you kind of got distracted by an eerie sight or what?
Yep, that was it.
That's funny how that happens. It happened to me today. Did I tell you guys this?
This is
just cutting me off. No.
This is one of those books that I do believe the movie is better.
Well, I strongly disagree with you, so we'll get into that.
Hey, Ian, what's this book about?
Oh, man. It's the story is pretty simple, actually. It's just the way it's told that makes it complex and forces some of us to abandon it 75% of the way through. The story begins with one of our main characters meeting Count Dracula and unwittingly helping Count Dracula go to England. And then a bunch of the story is about the shenanigans that Count Dracula gets up to in England and his body count and the various people he turns and how people gradually realize this is an undead monster and we have to do something about him. And then the last like third quarter of the book maybe is Count Dracula on the run, trying to get back to his ancestral castle and the epic chase that takes place. And there are all kinds of like really high stakes. There's the word stakes again. And
is that
the story,
vampire pun, or
yeah, it's a vampire pun because you use a wooden stake sometimes to stab them in the heart.
Okay,
super gross thing.
Make notes, usually, Joe, just in case.
It's pretty gruesome. Like it's like stabbing somebody is.
But check it out, okay. This book is like weirdly straight-laced about some things, but it's very, very grody about other things. For instance, when you stab a vampire in the heart in this book, it sprays blood everywhere. Mm. It's not
what happens
like
when you stab a normal person in the heart?
Does well, it not and spray, this is a concern. Everywhere?
It's a great question. It's a great literary question. People, thank you, Joe. What, Ian, just, please respond.
Blood sprays everywhere
blood
as well.
It does everywhere. Also, okay.
It's a concern.
Interesting. So yeah, I guess so, there's only one way to find out if somebody's a vampire or not.
But a lot of the lore is present too. So you can tell with garlic as well. And they don't have holy water. They don't use holy water. It's really, really fascinating. This is something I wasn't prepared for. This is what you do, right?
Hey guys.
Hey, what?
So you remember when we wrote our Butler book?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe not every episode, but just like, you know, as it comes to me, I think I'd just like to come up with concepts for our own books.
Ooh. So like you're saying not just the Butler, like not just a continuation of the Butler franchise, but like a vampire Butler or not Butler. We Adamantium Butler.
We can call him Butler. We can call him Butler.
No, there's no, stop mixing them. This is separate, but it is in the same world. Okay, so
we'll call it the Butlerverse, for instance.
I'm thinking like an Italian vampire who can't eat garlic, but he's like a chef, and it's kind of like a coming of age. So like, a building's Roman.
And he has to make the perfect dish, but it needs garlic, and he has to overcome his fear.
It's like Ratatouille meets Dracula.
I will say this doesn't sound very good. Let me ask a couple of clarifying questions. Does he sparkle?
Yeah. No, not unless there's glitter or something like that.
If somebody compliments his food, he like really glows. Like it's not a sparkle, but he glows.
Yeah, he gets glowing reviews on his some of his food that he makes.
He also glows in the dark, which is a weird trait for a vampire.
I feel like you've kind of ignored Chekhov's gun, all right? You've given this guy vampire teeth, right? You've made him a vampire.
Yes, he's got the teeth, yeah.
And like literally all that's doing in this story is he's now scared of garlic. You know, you could do the same thing with just some rando who's allergic to garlic. It doesn't have to be a vampire.
He can't use garlic. Okay, you know, in Ratatouille when it comes up to the big scene and he's trying to impress the judge?
Yeah.
Well, sorry to, you know, share some unavoidable spoilers right now, but he can't use garlic. So he doesn't get that great review like in Ratatouille. So he fucking kills him.
Also, all of his meals are just plates of blood.
Yeah.
Like just like differently seasoned plates of blood.
Well,
oh, is it a comedy now?
No.
Cuz that's pretty comedic.
Building's Roman. Yeah.
Well, you're going to
there'd be a lot of blood. So, probably some will get into some dishes. Yeah.
Maybe just like really rare stuff.
All of his steaks are rare.
Yeah, incredibly rare. Like so rare.
I'm just not seeing it. So,
you're not seeing the vision.
I'm not.
He just kills food reviewers.
He just
food bloggers.
That's a different bloggers.
Oh, so is it like a commentary on like the way capitalism is changing the restaurant industry? I love it.
Ian.
Yep.
Exactly.
Nice. Oh, and like it's an industry that just like eats people alive. It chews them up and spits them out. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. That's pretty good.
I do think there is a market space for a movie, a film of some sort where influencers are just hunted down, right? Like just hunted down, killed. If that's by a Dracula chef, fantastic, right? But I think it also could just be by like, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Just some psychos.
Yeah, could it be by a butler?
Can we throw Yelpers in there?
Yep. Instagrammers.
Yep. Do we have a title? Do we have a title for this masterpiece?
Let's see. Dracula? Maybe? I was thinking maybe Dracula.
Dracula is the title?
That's already taken. Okay, so this is one of the things you do with Dracula, the Dracula myth. You just make it your own and then you put something on the title to make it slightly different. So like Dracula is different from Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is different from Dracula
Abraham
Untold,
Lincoln,
which is different from Abraham Lincoln Dracula, which is different from Dracula Uprising, which is different from Dracula 2 Electric Boogaloo, and so on and so forth.
Why has this book become so iconic? Because basically the first?
I mean, like I was saying, it does this thing where it just cements the genre. So that, like I say, there are previously these really solid vampire stories, and there was a developing British literature. But this book takes so much of this tradition, and I think sets the tradition in its ideal form. So it phrases these ideas, it phrases these tropes and these images so beautifully. It communicates them in such a powerful way that you end up with this text, which is a foundation for a whole genre. And I was thinking about this, like I don't know of a lot of books which a whole genre is based on, but this is one of them, I think.
So I have read 75% of this book, so I do know a little bit about it.
You have 75% authority on it. Yes, go ahead.
Correct. I think one of the coolest things about this book is how it's written. So tell us about how it's written.
Yes, the epistolary stuff.
Well, I don't know what that word means, Ian,
I'd prefer you
not use that type of language on this podcast, but if you'd like to tell us about the book, that would be great.
So there is a mode of storytelling called the epistolary mode where the whole story is not communicated.
I'll bleep that out later.
Uh-huh, I hope you do. I hope you bleep out just that part of the word. So the story is told not from a narrator who sees and knows all. It's not told from just like one person's first person. It's told through a series of letters and diary entries and audio recordings. This is written in 1897, but they had phonographs which could record the human voice. And so there's a character who just like records his thoughts on wax cylinders. And so it's all built from these different sort of points of view, which are very limited. And the effect of this is kind of like, and you're going to mock me for this, it's kind of like Game of Thrones.
Okay, I'm ready to start mocking Joe. Are you ready?
In a good way. Okay,
yeah.
One of the things that kind of captured me about Game of Thrones, and probably other folks too, was how like the story will like follow one person up until it gets really good, and like something's about to happen to them, and then we shift like to a hugely distant area of the kingdoms, and we're now in this other place. And what this does is it keeps the suspense. It keeps us on our toes. And so finally, when we get back to that initial person, it's such a huge relief. Here we are again, and we're ready for them. And this story has this amazing cliffhanger, almost literally, where a character is like kind of in extreme danger, and it seems like the Count is coming for him. And then we don't hear about him for literally hundreds of pages.
Wow. And
yeah.
It's just like,
well, you're right. Yeah.
Oh, I disagree. I feel like you're wrong. I think that my experience when I read Game of Thrones is I come back to it and I say, wait, what was Tyrion doing again? Wait, what okay. What was happening again?
Right. So
that's not to say that doesn't happen here too.
Sure. Yeah. I think there is some of that, but it's a relatively small cast of characters, and he manages enough foreshadowing, enough like references. Like, so the guy who's missing, we shift to the perspective of his fiance. And so there is a lot of the fiance worrying about her man who is missing enough to keep us like, oh yeah, the last time we saw that dude, he was about to get got by Dracula.
Yeah.
And so he kind of keeps us remembering what's like, hey, I didn't tell you what happened to that dude. And then when we finally discover what happened to him, it's just this incredible like rush of a cathartic relief.
Is it entirely epistolary? Like everything is epistolary.
Yes.
Wow. I never knew that.
That's so gutsy. It's such a gutsy move, because when you do an epistolary,
it's creepy.
Oh my goodness. Okay,
it's
guys.
So fucking scary.
I'm gonna admit to something here. The only time I have to read, so I finish working in the lab and the monsters do their thing, and I leave the lab and I close the door and I lock it with multiple bars.
Did you turn the burners off?
Oh no, I gotta go back in and do that.
Okay, unlock the door and head back in.
Unlock the door. We'll wait. Flip on the lights. We'll wait. Turn off the burners. Yeah, just give me a second. Anyway, so I just went really quick and did it. So here's the thing. I had to read this book late at night, like after my spouse is asleep, after the sun has long gone down. We had like a cold front come through, so there was actually wind whistling around the eaves. And I am not an easily frightened person, but there was like,
you peed.
Is that how this story ends, Ian?
Now, let me just kind of explain this a little bit further, because you are building a world here. So Joe, I don't know if you know this, but vampires only come out at night. So this is like prime vampire time.
Yeah. Actually.
Wow. Wait. Do they come out during the day?
In Dracula, these vampires are technically daywalkers. They do not catch on fire when the sun hits them.
Where did that come from?
That feels like the better type of vampire to be, for sure. How do you get signed up for that one?
If you had to choose, you definitely choose.
Are they at least uncomfortable in the sun? Like, do they have to put on a ton of sunscreen and wear shades?
Is it a different genus? What's going on here?
No, this is just, I think that this story kind of gave rise to the vampire, which is afraid of the sun. But these vampires, they can live, they can be out in the sun, but they can't change their shape. They can't do all their, like, they have an incredible physical power. They can like turn into mist and they can squeeze through the narrow cracks. But unless they're like during the daytime, they are limited in their abilities. So
they're diminished.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, can I say one more thing about this before I wrap up? One more really awesome, cool thing about this book. So even though it's so, I don't know
spooky?
Where I was going with that. Oh, creepy. Yeah. Even though it's so creepy.
Mm-hmm. Creeptastic.
Please use the word spooktacular.
Spooktastic.
Sorry, I gotta be on brand here. The catchwords. Even though this is the most spooktacular of all of the books. Yeah, there it is. It has like a really good human heart to it. So in a lot of vampire fiction, the victims are kind of just used up and tossed aside. Kind of narratively. Like the narrative just takes them and like makes them fodder for the story. And right. in this story, these characters, who are all like really psychologically real and interesting and different and unique, they lose someone in the course of the story. And a lot of the rest of the story is motivated by a desire for revenge for the one person that they lost, and then an attempt to save somebody who is in danger. And it's not this grandstanding, we must save the world from the scourge of the undead. It's much more like, our friend was murdered by this person, by this monster. And our other friend has been seriously, seriously imperiled by this monster. Let's go revenge the death of the first friend and save the life of the second friend. And it's just really kind of sweet and personal and human. And I like that a lot.
Cool.
Yeah, sounds really nice.
It's worthwhile. Also, there's this little group of dudes who go to fight Dracula. And the one female character, the men keep trying to sideline her, like, oh, you're going to be too weak, it's too dangerous for you. And the story keeps pushing her back into the center of it. And she ends up being the best detective of all of them. And she's hugely important in the fight against Dracula. And she's there at the very end of the story. And so it's really cool. The story kind of resists the impulse of the men. So
ahead of its time.
Speaking of vampires, can I tell you guys a Hobbit fact?
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, vampires, right? We got to talk about vampires in the Tolkien legendary.
Were there
right?
vampires in The Hobbit?
There no. actually were, yes. At the Battle of Five Armies, there's a huge cloud of blood-sucking bats that show up on the side of the goblins, and they fight on the side of the goblins. And within the broader Tolkien legendarium, vampires, or at least vampire-like beings, do exist. For instance, the Dark Lord himself, Sauron, can take the form of a vampire bat before he forges and then loses the One Ring. There are others too. So vampires show up in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings.
Is this book 500 pages?
It's not. It's so the version I read on my phone was
in the lab.
It was in the lab. Well, I kind of hooked it up so I could see it above me while I was working in the lab late one night. Then I would kind of like my eyes would stray aside and they would see this eerie sight.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Anyway.
Yeah, Nick, it's my turn, right?
the book clocks in at not 900 pages. That's how long mine was. 418 pages. There we go.
All right. Cool. So, sounds great. I did not know it was epistolary. Today I learned it's an epistolary novel.
It is. It's pretty awesome. You should read it.
Wait, what was the first vampire book?
The first vampire story was a story called The Vampire, spelled V-A-M-P-Y-R-E.
That's a real spelling.
Polidori.
Yeah.
But that's just the first English vampire story. So there have been a lot since then, and also there were others before then too.
Yeah, you said this is like in the bones of Central Europeans. Like this is just like this is in the dirt.
If you guys are familiar at all with the Witcher series of books and games and TV show and so forth, multimedia empire, like this, it's that series like captures just how in a certain part of the continent, people just held on to these incredibly amazing, wacky folklore tales for so long. You really get into it a lot.
Hey guys, next Monday is November 2nd. Can you guys think of any fun literature that aligns with that exact date?
With November 2nd? I mean, it's kind of a random date. Nick.
Remember, the 2nd of November, the Gunpowder Treason and Plot. I know of no reason why the Gunpowder Treason. Oh, I forgot.
That wasn't the 2nd. Yeah. Ooh, that's good, though. That's close. Shit. Can we just release this on the 5th of November instead? And then we could talk about Alan Moore.
Can't do it.
There's another Alan Moore book that we could do. It's Batman the Killing Joke takes place on November 1st. So we could do
That won't do. That's Sunday. Close.
Oh, I won't do.
That's our day of rest.
Well, wait a second. Isn't Swamp Thing? Isn't that entire thing set on November 3rd? Swamp Thing,
yeah.
Alan Moore?
It's a whole like an election closer. Thing. Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I think we might just have to give up and Watchmen. Right. might just have to be kind
let's
of
just
a,
do what yeah a can't figure it out let's just do Watchmen
yeah, okay.
Let's
go with Alan Moore Watchmen. All right, well,
Joe.
Yeah.
What book did you tell us about your screws?
I brought a ghost story, a very spooky ghost story.
Ooh.
Now, Joe, be warned. I have read this book and I have a fairly low opinion of it. So,
okay, well, cool story. Can we disconnect Ian's audio, please?
No problem.
stage a revolt in the lab. I got to go take care of it.
Right. All right. So, guys, I'm gonna fess up to you. I had a really, really hard time coming up with a book to read this week. Wow. I wanted to read something new. Like Ian, I think
must have
Ian
been a very spooky feeling.
It was disheartening. I don't like spooky things.
Nothing more terrifying than being disheartened.
Yeah, I don't like spooky things. Like my entire life, I've had kind of just a not a revulsion to them, but they've bounced off me. You know,
let me ask you this, Joe.
Yep.
Do you like roller coasters?
Well,
no.
I mean,
let me ask you this, Joe. Are you a big brave boy?
I'm a brave boy. I prefer not putting myself in situations where I need to be brave. I feel like the need for bravery can largely be mitigated. That's right. So I didn't have a long list of stuff that I had read before that coming into this week. So I thought, okay, that's cool. I'm going to read some lists. I'm going to see if I can find something that appeals to me. And I found this novel. This Japanese translation of what was it called? The Piercing. It was Piercing, it was called.
Oh boy, and it was this does not sound good.
Yeah, it was pretty enticing. Like the very first scene in that novel is this guy standing over his baby holding an ice pick in its crib. And
yeah, that entices me right there.
Mm-hmm. His entire internal monologue is him going, I'm not gonna stab this baby with this ice pick. I'm definitely not gonna stab this baby with this ice pick. Oh, but what if I stabbed this baby with this ice pick, right? And he, so it was kind of interesting.
That's one word for it.
I got about halfway through that book and it just wasn't doing it with me. Like that ice pick could only grip you for so long, right? So then I said, well, I'm running out of time. I think I'm going to talk about Jane Eyre this week. Jane Eyre is a kind of a gothic novel, this kind of spooky thing that I think we should talk about sometime. But I told my wife, my dear wife, that I wanted to talk about Jane Eyre. And she told me flat out, Jane Eyre is not scary. Mm. And I said, well, it's not scary, but it's like a little bit spooky and a little bit mysterious. Yeah. And she's like, yeah, but it's not scary.
Is it spooktacular?
It's not spooktacular. I agree with her.
You heard
it
here first.
It's not spooktacular.
Jane Eyre, not spooktacular.
So, Joe, you brought Jane Eyre. I'm confused.
So, a couple days ago, my wife and I were browsing Netflix.
This is quite the prequel going on to this book presentation.
My wife and I are looking through Netflix.
I'm going to wind up and say I didn't have a book.
Building up the lore to this book selection.
I'm going to talk for 25 minutes how I didn't choose a book this week, guys.
Fucking hell.
A couple days ago, my wife and I are browsing through Netflix, right? And we see the number two trending thing is The Haunting of Bly Manor, which looks really spooky. And I got a little bit curious about it. And I found out that it is based on this Henry James novella called The Turning of the Screw in 1898.
I'm going to have to stop you right there. I'm going to have to stop you right there. We have decided in this podcast use the correct pronunciation.
I'm sorry. Let me try again. Novella.
Thank you.
All right. The Henry James Novella.
Is anybody else really disturbed? And maybe you're going to get into this, Joe, but as we've discussed, it's my job to ruin your notes. Mm-hmm. Is this at all based on The Taming of the Shrew?
I wonder how intentional it is. I'm sure
because these names must be right next to each other in the library. I mean, you just gotta accidentally grab the wrong one and you're gonna have a bad time.
That's such insightful criticism. You know, it's like you would name your business like AAA Towing, right? Like, so that you can be first in this phone book. Do you think that he named it this so he could be next to Shakespeare?
Welcome to my restaurant, Rick Donald's. Yeah. Terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that probably for
I'm sorry. Nick Donalds.
Nick Donalds.
You had it right there. Come on.
Oh, shit. My God. Should have paused.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Man, take that back. Take that back and get clean audio on that.
No.
So I read this and it is a pretty spooky ghost story by what some people have called the greatest novelist in the English language. It is.
We start with that.
Some people call Henry James the greatest novelist in the English language. Who?
Would you like me to read his Wikipedia page? There is no footnote, but it said some people.
Please read his Wikipedia page in a vampire voice.
I read a ghost story, not a vampire voice. I will read it in a ghost voice. But this story has a lot of cool stuff. It has like spooky houses. It has creepy children. It has a beautiful young governess. It has mysterious disappearances. Like maybe a child molester is in it.
Why would you say that? Like it's a good thing.
I didn't say good it's a news, good thing.
It's, good. It's got, this book has it all.
And it has ghosts. It has ghosts. And overall, I thought it was a pretty solid read. I enjoyed it. Nick, I would recommend this pretty solid read to you.
Joe.
Yes.
Tell us about your book.
All right. This novella is told from the point of view of this beautiful young governess, and she's taking a job looking after a pair of orphans at their country estate, Bly Manor. She has two charges, a boy who's about 10 years old, his name is Miles, and a girl who's about 8 years old, her name is Flora. And they seem perfectly pleasant. In fact, they seem like kind of great, but something about them, you know how like Victorian kids have like this really creepy, unsettling air about them?
Play with us, Daddy.
Like yeah, that? Something about them is very unsettling. The boy has recently been expelled from his boarding school. Nobody says why. The parents died earlier under vague circumstances, and we don't know what they are. The last governess, she's also dead under mysterious circumstances. And the reader follows this governess, like this new governess, through her first-person point of view, her first-person narrative, her first-person account of this, as she slowly becomes convinced that these grounds, like that Bly Manor, is haunted. And she's pretty sure the kids can see the ghosts too and are talking to them.
What's a governess? Is this like...
Yeah. So this is
she just rich?
It's like the female version of a governor. So you've heard of an actor.
No. Yes, no. I'm gonna have to stop you guys right there.
Okay. So what state did she govern over?
A governess, Nick, is basically a tutor. Or like a nanny. You might call her like an au pair. It might be what we call it now. She's like this young woman from actually kind of a modest background who gets hired by this super rich guy to raise these two kids. By the way, the two kids are not his. They're raised. It's like the uncle is in charge of them after the parents' death, and he wants nothing to do with them. So he literally hires this governess and says, "Hey, I don't want to hear anything about these kids. Please do not contact me. Hang out in the house. You're good."
This sounds like The Sound of Music because you've got a governess, you've got a man.
You have Nazis.
Nazis. Yep.
There are Nazis, yes.
Do they try and solve a problem like Maria?
Is this a musical, Joe?
There is no singing.
Are the hills alive with The Sound of Music?
Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of discussion of hills. There's a lake. Mm-hmm. There's some towers on the property. It sounds like a lovely place. Not a lot of hills. Not a lot of music. She is totally in love with the guy that hires her. Oh, right. And yeah, she's totally in love with him.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
Do they screw?
Wow.
Well, hey, Nick, don't say that gross giggle in your voice. That's horrible. That is the worst thing. That's the most spooky thing I've heard.
Don't answer that.
Ian, how familiar are you with Henry James?
Ugh, too familiar.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, snap.
More familiar than I'd like. He's doing it.
What? Hey guys, what's with all the tension?
Yeah, so there is Henry James is. I've read one thing by Henry James before this. I read Daisy Miller when I was in college, and I have a vague recollection of like I liked Daisy Miller. Like I didn't love it, but I think of it from time to time. Like I thought it was fine. I thought it was pretty good. Henry James. I was reading a lot about him for this, and apparently they talk about Henry James having three eras in his writing. It's called James the First, early in his career, when he is kind of famed for his succinct and to the point writing. James the Second, in which it evolves slightly, and James the Third, which they call the Notorious Pretender, because as he goes on, he becomes incredibly verbose. And fun fact about Henry James, it corresponds almost exactly to when he stopped writing his novels himself and instead would dictate them to a typist.
Oh, that's concerning.
Yeah, it is a little concerning. A few more fun facts about Henry James. I've got some on him, not a ton. Henry James is not a pseudonym. Doesn't it really seem like it would be a pseudonym?
What a waste of a name.
It's not exciting enough to be a pseudonym. If you're going to do a
yeah, exactly.
If you're going to do a pseudonym, you could do something funky like Charles Dodgson or Mark Twain.
Yeah.
Or George Eliot. Did you guys know George Eliot was this famous Victorian novelist who wrote a bunch of books, George Eliot, and then it turns out she was actually a lady?
Yeah. In fact, Ian, that's literally the only thing I know about George Eliot. like my file cards, is the front of it says George Eliot. The back of it says actually a woman.
There we go.
Ian, why do you fucking hate this guy?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So I had to read the screw.
He just sucks.
I think it has a lot to do with your expectations. So when I first saw that Will Smith movie, I Am Legend, which is also a vampire story. I watched the trailers and I thought it was going to be a super awesome action flick. And then it turns out I got like a meditative story about Will Smith trying to survive in New York. And it wasn't necessarily a bad movie. It just didn't fit my expectations. Same thing with Turn of the Screw. When I broke this off, I was like, okay, here we go. Ghost stories. And sure, it's creepy, but it seemed like it took forever for things to happen. And there was a lot more suggestion than actual plot. Like, I like a story where things happen as opposed to maybe something happened or maybe it didn't.
There's a lot of ruminating on what may or may not have happened in this book, right? There's a lot of like these little glimpses of it's like, oh shit, something just happened. And like, I will say like every chapter, this is published serial as we've talked about before on here. And Ian's not a fan of serial publications for some pretty good reasons, I think. But I will say every chapter ends with like this kind of great cliffhanger. Every chapter makes you want to pick up the next chapter and read it. However, I do agree that like there'll be this glimpse of action and then a large body of them like ruminating on what happened and talking about like, what do you think that was? I think it was this.
Let's get off this negative bandwagon that
Yeah, let's talk about some fun stuff.
I thought you were going to talk shit about the author, not about the book.
Yeah, jeez, Ian.
Jesus, Ian, stop being so negative.
So
it's this, spooktacular, this, not
yeah,
something else.
It's spooky to me. It's spooky to me how much undeserved praise Henry James gets.
Go back to the lab. Joe, tell us some exciting things about your book. So we know it's about a young strapping young woman with legs and arms who is in this house taking care of her these children. What else? Tell us about the book. Tell us about the author.
Well, I've told you most of what I have about the author.
Nothing else. He had three. What else he got in your notes there?
He was nominated 3 times for a Nobel Prize in literature. He never won it. Yeah, it's very sad.
Okay, now I feel bad for him.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Because of haters like Ian.
I got a question. You can get nominated. I didn't know the Nobel had nominations.
How do you like just to, like, win it? Always be the one that lost it. Like, you know how the Oscars always pan over the losers, right? At the ceremony, and they have like, how do you feel that Henry James, like 3 years in a row, is just sitting there clapping for whatever Chucklefuck won it?
Chucklefuck. That'd have been a better pseudonym.
Honestly, though, it's kind of Henry James's fault because, as we saw with Ernest, all you have to do to get a Nobel is headbutt your way out of an airplane, and they'll be like, "Oh no." Give him
a
Nobel.
He's going to die.
So it's agreed he should have been a better storyteller.
That too, perhaps.
I am sick of you guys piling on Henry James.
Hey,
I thought this,
Joe, fuck
I thought
your book.
This was great. So this was written in what's been called the golden age of the ghost story.
And oh, whoa. I want to hear more about the golden age of ghost stories.
in the late 1800s, early 1900s, really in America and England, people were crazy for ghost stories. They started getting published in even just normal consumer magazines. So it wasn't like this weird extra, it wasn't this weird niche thing. It was just like people would pick up their Harper's Magazine or whatever it was, and there would be a ghost story that week or an installment of a ghost story that week. And it was just this genre of fiction that people really, really were into.
Why? Why did they like it?
Yeah, I guess why.
Well, I don't, I wonder, why people like scary things at all, right? Like, we talk about roller coasters, we talk about horror movies, and I'm probably the worst person to answer this, because the question is why do people like scary things? My answer is I don't know, but my high school freshmen seem to love it. Like, they read horror books all the time. They read horror books in March, you know, these people love it. Why do you guys like it?
I think there's a degree of, especially with ghost stories, there's a degree of power to watching a movie, a scary movie, or reading a scary book, and then going out and standing in the sunlight and reassuring myself that's not real. It's like an exercise in setting yourself up and getting yourself all keyed up in order that you can say, but it's not real, and that feels good.
Like waking up from a bad dream, right? Like, we can make ourselves force, we can induce
right,
that
yeah.
in ourselves.
You're giving yourself a bad dream, which you then can wake yourself up from. And I think that's delicious. I also think that a lot of people just love the idea that there are forces that we cannot understand. There are forces beyond our comprehension. And I'm not sure why people like that, but I think that's a thing that people enjoy.
But in the late 1800s, early 1900s, people were kind of nuts for ghost stories. We get some famous ones. We get The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. We get A Christmas Carol in that time, right? Like, these famous ghost stories that are still with us today. And I would also say that ghost stories are still a part of our, lives, right? We've all seen the movie Ghostbusters. And even though that's a very silly example, that is a blockbuster movie based around the premise that there are ghosts in New York City. This has a framing device. And the very first chapter of this book, everybody's sitting around on Christmas Eve telling each other ghost stories. And that made me wonder, is telling ghost stories on Christmas Eve, is that a thing? Because I had never heard of it. Have you guys ever heard of this?
No.
Nope.
Yeah,
sounds Norwegian.
Okay, so I thought the same thing. I'm like, I've never heard of telling ghost stories on Christmas Eve, but I started looking into it, and sure enough, it's a thing, right? It's not a thing that has survived very well to this day, but at a time, it was tradition that you would tell ghost stories on Christmas Eve. And of course, if you've heard the song, It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year, you have heard the lyric, there'll be parties for hosting, marshmallows for toasting, and caroling out in the snow. There'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago.
Shit. So where does this come from?
It's a thing. It comes from England, as far as we can tell, although people in England now say, yeah, we don't do that anymore. But it shows up in literature of the time. We even see it in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, which is, of course, a ghost story at its heart, right? Is a story of...
True. Hang on. Joe, yeah. are you putting forward, are you trying to invalidate the whole point of this spooktacular episode? Are you claiming that spooky season is in fact not Spooktober, but in fact Spooksember?
I smell a sequel.
Spooky season two.
I smell a Christmas sequel. See you guys in December for Spooktacular 2.
So then I started to
Electric
dig into
Spookaloo.
It.
Electric Spookaloo.
Spookaloo, excuse me.
Please get it right.
So one of the reasons that ghost stories have this tradition at Christmas is because Christmas is at the winter solstice, right?
Sure,
winter, and it really is this traditional calendar end of the year, right? In which the days are short. And a lot of people say Christmas is celebrated in Europe and the US as it was originally connected to this pagan winter solstice celebration and the festival known as Yule. The darkest day of the year was seen by many as a time when the dead would have a particularly good access to the living.
Oh.
So that's just a fun fact for you.
That's concerning.
Yeah.
So we're coming close to that, you guys.
Okay.
Can I ask you, gentlemen, what you've done to protect yourself against the depredations of the evil dead?
I have surrounded myself with garlic. I have sharpened all of my wooden stakes.
Yeah, but those are just good for vampires. Like if you stab a ghost with a wooden stake, it's not going to do jack.
I'm currently turning my desk table into a wooden stake.
Nick has a backpack that turns into a vacuum cleaner, or that is a vacuum cleaner. Is that correct, Nick?
Not true. What are you talking about?
I've seen you vacuum with it. Nick has a vacuum that you wear on your back, guys.
A vacuum, you might say.
A vacuum. And that would be perfect. Nick, you don't have to be embarrassed. That would be perfect for ghosts.
Thank you.
So this is, okay, as you're talking about this, I'm seeing a really fascinating connection with Dracula, which is that in both of them, you have limited first person like point of view, right? You don't have an omniscient point of view. So we are forced to know just as much as a limited narrator can provide us. Yes. Is this fair to say?
Of course. Yes.
Okay. So I think, and it sounds like, sorry, it sounds kind of like in this book, bad stuff, which we kind of hardened and jaded modern readers were like, oh, it's totally ghosts, or it's totally a vampire. We know what's the horrible thing, but they don't. And I think it's like one of the spookiest things is a lack of knowledge. Part of the horror and part of like the hair pulling out anxiety of this book is like, we see what's gonna happen, but they can't. And it's like, I think what it does to us as readers, maybe, is makes us think, what are my blind spots? Like, what vampires am I missing? What creepy
what
ghost
vampires
kids
are
am I
in
missing?
My own life? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. So I love that you bring up the
maybe that could be
narrator.
The name of the book.
The Vampire Within.
Yeah, the subtext.
Our vampire. Ooh.
The subtitle. The Vampire Within.
Subtext. Also the subtext.
Yeah.
Okay. True. This book is framed by Henry James as just a very classic Jamesian ghost story. Right?
Wait like a minute. This. Does he have his own thing? Jamesian?
He wrote one and he's like, oh, that's a classic Jamesian.
Actually, named after a different James.
Wait, named after a different James? Oh, yeah. Rick James?
Yes, named after Rick James. Thank you.
Little joke for our listeners.
Yeah, I didn't even have anything to add to that. That was perfect on its own.
It was good.
Good. Anyway,
so
go ahead.
It's often called the most ambiguous ghost story in the English language. And as we read it, it's really tricky to tell how reliable our young governess is. Because viewed through one lens, it's a ghost story. Like, it's just a straight up ghost story. But viewed through another lens, it's like this young woman slowly descending into like madness as her friends and coworkers go on. And there are very real questions as you read this of, wait a second, is this all in her head? Like, is she just imagining all of this? Because you can view it like the motivations, the actions, the dialogue of all the other characters surrounding her make total sense with either reading of this. And I think that's why it's such a famous piece. It is Henry James' most adapted work. It's been adapted 28 times. It is currently on Netflix as a, I watched the first episode, guys, and also very spooky story.
So it's of the same name, Joe?
On Netflix, it is called The Haunting of Bly Manor. The Haunting of Bly Manor on Netflix.
All right.
Yeah. And I think like, as I was reading that, I think the most fun part of it was forcing myself to see the narrative through those two different lenses and seeing how both of them, this is crafted in such a way that both of those readings make total sense.
That's not easy to do. I'll give grudging praise to Mr. Henry James. Like, to a lot of times there's the story that you think is a ghost story and then it turns out it's all in someone's head or vice versa.
Right.
But like to have a story that's so carefully fine-tuned that it walks this knife edge where you could like all that changes it from one to the other is like how you're feeling that day. Like, are you willing to believe her or are you willing to believe in psychology? I think that's kind of cool.
I guess I hate to do this. Ian, you lose. But just to be clear, I don't know if Joe's book wins. but Henry James has been denied so many awards his life.
True. That poor guy. Right.
20 Nobel Peace Prizes I'm seeing right here in the records.
Did you know that anyone can be nominated specifically for a Nobel Peace Prize?
Whoa. Let me read you this Nobel Prize
requirements.
Nick is just down the rabbit hole.
This rule. All right. The 50-year secrecy rule.
Oh.
Listen to this.
What?
Yeah. Okay. Hey, Joe, when was your book written?
My book was written in 1898.
Oh, never mind. We're good. That makes sense. All right. The 50-year secrecy rule. All right. So the committee does not itself announce the names of the nominees, neither to the media nor to the candidate themselves. But don't they have to submit a nomination? All right. Insofar as certain names crop up in the advancements. Okay. It goes on. So that means after... nobody said it for 50 years after he was nominated.
That's
so he
really
probably
cool.
didn't even know he was nominated, or did he?
Oh, well, that's nice.
So that makes me wonder. I want to know. I have two immediate follow up questions.
Never mind. Ian, you win.
Who was the Nobel Prize winner 50 years ago, and who were the Nobel Prize runner ups 50 years ago?
Yeah, let's start blasting people.
I bet it's like Martin Luther King. What is it? It's 2020 right now. What was 50 years ago? 1970? No, not quite.
Grand Funk Railroad.
No, it was like, he was like 1963 or something like that.
Oh no.
So congratulations, Henry James.
Thank you.
I do want to see if we can get nominated for a Peace Prize though. So
I would love that.
But in the meantime, congratulations, Henry James.
Are you, Joe, do you accept this in loco?
Do you accept
parentis?
This on behalf
of Henry James, guys, on behalf of Henry James, I will accept this prize. And as a closing quote, I actually have a piece of criticism from Henry James. I'm not going to say something critical about him, but I have a piece of criticism talking about this book specifically. One of the critics of this novel, a Jamesian critic, which is apparently...
can't fucking use it like that. I hate this.
It's not too late, Nick, to take it away from Joe and give it to me. I don't say stuff like Jamesian.
Oh, that. Well, that's actually ironically very Jamesian, Ian.
No.
Shoot.
This critic says that all such attempts to solve this book, however admiringly tendered, unwittingly work towards its diminution. Its profoundest pleasure lies in the beautifully fussed over way in which James refuses to come down on either side. The book becomes a modest monument to the bold pursuit of ambiguity.